15 minutes after 4 o'clock, it is downtown on a Monday afternoon, first day of February. Rich Kimble, Ryan Wehning, Brian Stackpole here, and on the G&M Family Market phone line, we're joined by Bob Ryan, columnist emeritus of the Boston Globe. Bob, good Monday afternoon.
Bob, good afternoon to you, Rich.
Let's talk a little basketball here to kick things off. I loved your column yesterday in the Globe talking about the three-point shot. And take us back to Chris Ford making a little NBA history.
Well, it was October 12th, 1979, opening night. And it was actually ballyhooed, of course, as Larry Bird's first NBA official regular season game. That was the big attraction going into it, of course. And then we got fascination and curiosity about the Celtics, who had gotten Bird and signed ML Carr and gotten a healthier Tiny Archibald and so forth. And it was a lot. But the other thing was, it was going to be the opening night of the first year of the three-point shot. And it just so happened that due to the time situation and the way the games were arranged that night, the Celtics went off, as I believe, at 7 p.m., perhaps 7:30, but I think it was even earlier. I think it was 7 in those days. And so in the first quarter, the score was 17-16 Houston, and the Celtics came down on transition, and instead of cutting to the basket, which is what people had been trained to do, and Chris Ford was as orthodox a player as you could have, he drifted into the corner, and I think probably waved his hand, and he got a pass, and he took a deep breath and made what was basically a one-hand set, and it went in, and it was the first three-point shot successful in the history of the NBA. And from that point on, that gave birth to Stephon Curry and everybody else. So now, obviously, it had been in the ABA from its inception and therefore had been dormant for 3 years, since the ABA had been out of business with the merger in the NBA with the NBA in 76. It had not. It was the first time it was in the NBA, and rich people just didn't know what to do with it. There were only that night one other shot made. That was by Rick Barry. And for most of that season, most teams ignored it.
Well, and that was what was most surprising to me in your column yesterday, is that Larry Bird, who we think about as one of the best three-point shooters of all time, didn't take many for the several seasons, first several seasons after the rule
went into
effect.
Well, the funny thing is, Rich, that year he took 140, so he made 58, and he did take some advantage of it, but more than a lot of people. And Ford took the most advantage with the Celtics that year. In fact, at one point, I think he made a three in like 24 out of 25 games. We thought that was unimaginably great. And we've seen what we have. But the next year, and for the next 4 years, Larry ignored it for the most part, and very, 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 very seldom. And then it wasn't until the sixth year, 85-86, that he went back to where he was that first year. And then from that point on, he made a far more of a point to shoot threes. I got to talk to him about this. It's so funny. What was going through his mind and why he... I mean, I know he didn't like it, but just because he didn't like it didn't mean he didn't recognize its value. But he didn't use it. You're right.
Well, and as you've said, look, it's here to stay. It's not going away. And regardless of what happens in the NBA, my concern with the three-point shot has been the trickle-down and what it's done to basketball at the lower levels, especially when you get down to high school and even younger grades, where kids have changed their shot because now they're firing up threes from their hip.
Absolutely. It's preposterous. Kids 9 years old should not be shooting threes, obviously, and yet this is the trend, and I understand that. It's a bad thing for the game. I believe very firmly that it's distorted the game and it's changed the concept of the game, and it's given us a phrase that is odious to my ears, and that phrase is, the worst shot in basketball is the long two. And I know that's a Pitino belief, and I know many people share it. I hate hearing that. I just can't stand it. And I just hate this. I'm a horror, this mania. And sometimes it's just crazy. Last night, the Celtics shot 46 threes. Well, of course, the problem is, the math of it is, it does work. They made 15, so that's 45 points. They would have needed 23 two-pointers to exceed that. I understand all that, but I just think that the emphasis on it has taken away good low post play, and God knows it's taken away the good mid-range game. Now, a lot of people say we want to get rid of the clutter of the low post. Yeah, I agree, clutter and banging around. That doesn't mean that you don't want people to know how to play down there, and there are very few people who do now. You know, the Celtics of the mid-'80s had the perfect balance. Think about it. Bird had the three, and Danny was an excellent three-point shooter, and that's fine. But they also had McHale and Parrish in the low post. they could run. Dennis Johnson was not much of a three-point shooter. He was a 15, 16, 17, 18-foot shooter. They had it all. They covered all the bases. Very few teams today cover all the bases.
Bob, this is Ryan Waning. Is there a Celtics team historically, since you've been following them for so long, that reminds you of this year's incarnation?
Not really. Not in its composition, necessarily. It's such a parity team. I mean, obviously the star is Isaiah Thomas now. He's emerged. He's been given an all-star status, and I'm not going to deny him. I think he's earned it. As much as, I mean, there's other guys you could argue, but he's one of them, and he got it good for him. But after that, there's so many guys that are equal in this team. It's an odd team, and I think it was going, I said from the beginning, it's going to be a difficult team for Brad Stevens to coach and find a rotation, and he still hasn't settled on a permanent rotation, but lately it's a first unit, second unit. Doesn't include David Lee. I never would have believed that. No, not really. It's a very interesting and different kind of Celtic team, in my opinion.
We're talking with Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Bob, there's been some talk in Major League Baseball about the National League adopting the designated hitter rule, although recently Commissioner Manfred said he doesn't see it happening right away. Is that something that should be done to unify the game between the two leagues?
There is no other reason. There's nothing else that separates the leagues. There's no more National League presidency. American League presidency. There are no leagues per se. There are no the umpires are under one roof. Once they did that and they consolidated that, there really was no more difference in the league, except for this preposterous idea that one of them plays one set of rules and one plays another, and it does kind of. And then the final reason time that they should have decided they had to have one set of rules was when they split this into the 15-team leagues, and now we have a minor league game every night. And that's absurd. So they've got to cut one way or the other. I would be in favor of keeping I'm more of a National League guy in that sense, but let's pick one, and I'll live with it happily. We have to have one. I think it's utterly ridiculous. And I think the way they're going to have to go is the DH way because of the union. The union will fight to the death and probably would go to war and strike over losing jobs and that they've come accustomed to. So if that's the way it has to go, okay. Yeah, there's a romance attached to the pitcher's batting, and I'm all for it. There are some terrific hitters left, maybe five or six, not too many. But in the final analysis, somebody made a good point I read yesterday. These guys now, because the minor leagues are all DHs, these guys come to the National League, and they're not trained to hit at all. Mm-hmm. They didn't hit since high school. They're liable to get hurt. And somebody wants some running bases or anything else. So you know, let's just get the DH in, I suppose, and do it. Yes, it's got to happen sooner rather than later.
Well, as the man who refers to baseball as the greatest game to spring from the mind of mortal man, we've been through the steroid era with a lot of home runs, a lot of offense. As a kid, I remember cheering in those days of the year of the pitcher, 1968, when you had ridiculous numbers. For you as a baseball fan, when was the best baseball played?
You know, I know it wasn't the 50s when it was station-to-station baseball. People romanticized the 50s and post-World War II. Well, one year, Don DiMaggio led the American League in stolen bases with 15. And so I want to thank Louis Aparicio first and Murray Wills second for putting the stolen base back into baseball. And yet we went to a tremendous era with it. And now we're, those numbers have come down. Nobody's replacing 100 anymore. There's a balance. I would say maybe in the 70s, after baseball lowered the mound and put some more of offense back in, and before steroids came into baseball, there was a good balance. We had guys that could pitch 250 innings. We had complete games, which I think are important. We didn't have this bullpen, mania that not only is hard to watch but slows down the game. Perhaps maybe a period of time. From roughly 1970 to whenever we want to date the entrance of steroids in the 90s, heavily. Look, there's never been a pure period of baseball. Well, it hasn't been since amphetamines came in the game. I always kid that there's three home run champions, okay? Babe Ruth was the champion of what I call the booze and broads era, and Hank Aaron was the champion of the greeny era, and Barry Bonds was the champion of the steroid era. And so it's that, I digressed. I'm sorry. I went off on a tangent.
No, anytime you can mention the Booze and Broads era, I'm in.
That's great. But seriously, stuff. I mean, you know, that was what I was in. And we had the Greenies. And let's be honest, the Masons and the Irons, and God knows, Pete Rose lived on Greenies. And all those guys played in the Greenie era. And none of them were, they were all sitting in a dish in the clubhouse. And that was the way you got through that 162-game season. And it was August 28th, and it was hot as hell, and we didn't feel like playing. So you popped a couple of greenies, and they all did it. They can't deny it.
Absolutely. So, Bob, the Super Bowl this weekend, for New England fans, it's a rough week. They're expecting to be there. Game aside, can you help me understand, do you understand the hatred that Patriots fans have of Peyton Manning?
Well, it's a rivalry thing anymore. Is it any different than Nomar versus Jeter? Is it any different than Bird Magic? Is it any different than pick your Canadian over the years, or whether the Canadian of the moment was? It's all a rivalry thing, and he has a great rival in Brady, and they happen to have parallel careers for the most part. It's no different than DiMaggio and Williams, and Russell and Chamberlain. That's probably the best one, in terms of venom. So although Jeter probably was second, and even though he didn't do anything to antagonize anybody other than be a Yankee and be great, I think that's all there is to it. And that's healthy when it's under control. You know, people just have a limit. You know, the Red Sox Yankee thing at times has gotten completely out of control, irrational. You know, when people are sitting there yelling Yankees, you know what, and they're playing the Royals, it's something that's a little sick. I don't endorse that. But I don't think that the Peyton and the Brady thing reached that level. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Bob, always great talking with you. Thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome. Nice to be with you always.
We'll see you soon. That's Bob Ryan, Boston Globe here. Downtown's 27 after 4 o'clock.